WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and we have one heck of a lineup for you. Of course, we kick things off with the State House Report with State Representative Josh Cutler. Each week, of course, we try to feature a different individual from up on Beacon Hill. Representative, I know you wanted to say hi, and I kind of stopped
you. I was going to say good evening, everyone. Good to be with you, Kevin. Thank you. Good evening to all the listeners out there. It's great to be back. It's been a little while since I've been on the show, so... A little rusty, but I'll shake it off.
I have to say, he's not only a state representative, but he is also an author.
Yes.
So we'll tease. We had you on a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your new book.
Yes.
Gentleman's Mob. Very cool.
Thank you.
We'll talk with the representative about a number of
lots going on. Yeah. Big Celtics game tonight too. So. Looking forward to that.
How are you going
to
split your focus between working on House Budget 2 and whether or not the Celtics are going to close out the suite?
It's a very good question. I have to go to town meeting, too, in one of my towns. So we'll be juggling some things, but that's okay.
Yeah, you're going to have two Mondays in a row with dealing with the town meetings, right? Because next week is Hanson.
Yes. Yeah, so it's 'tis the season.
So you're going to the Marshfield town meeting tonight?
Yes. I now have part of Marshfield in my district, so yeah, exactly.
How fun is that?
It is fun. It's fun to have a new town or to, you know, be able to meet some new folks. Although I'm a former Marshfield resident, so I feel like I feel somewhat pretty comfortable coming back to Marshfield, but it'll be fun.
Okay. So we'll talk with the representative about a couple of different things, not only about how the first day of the budget is going, but we also want to chat with him about one of the committees that he actually had co-chaired and had put out a report. Also, I wanted to take a moment to chat with the representative about a theft, as far as theft and wages.
The wage theft bill?
Wage theft bill. We'll talk a little bit about
that. Sure, yeah. Glad to talk about
we'll that. Do that coming up in just a few moments, as well as, I don't know if I teased this or not, but the future of work in Mass. They put out a report a few weeks ago.
I know.
We'll dig into that.
I wrote it, yes.
And we'll get your take on how it's been met and what it will look to do when it comes to our future workforce.
That sounds great. It sounds like a full agenda.
Yes, maybe we don't have enough time.
I could entertain. I could.
Should you tell the rest of the guests?
Just tell the rest of the guests. We don't. Take the night off.
We're all set.
Cutler's gotcha.
Well, then that'll disappoint Danica Buckley, who is.
No, I wouldn't want to do that. And I'm sure your listeners would tire of, you know, me eventually. So.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. You've served as a co-host in the past.
Well, thank you. You're kind.
Core Arts Society director and conductor Danica Buckley will be joining me, and we're going to talk a little bit about an upcoming performance that's taking place next Sunday. We'll talk about some of the songs, some of the program that they have in store, and what it all means. We get to find out more about the Core Arts Society itself and this upcoming performance, which is going to be What a Wonderful World, Songs of Earth, Sea, and Sky. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that. Hour number two. Got a good friend, Chris DiOrio, coming in. Chris has been in for a variety of different things. When we first had him in, actually, we had his son, Dominic, in. As his son was a little philanthropic, wanted to help those in need and started something called Dom's Dimes. Well, we're not talking about Dom's Dimes tonight. Actually, we're going to talk to Chris about running the 126th Boston Marathon. He did that last Monday while we were sitting here going blah, blah, blah. He was pushing it to get over the finish line. He actually, there's a little bit of a media, there was a story. Boston media happened to be there capturing when he and another runner were crossing the finish line, and they got a couple of words from him. The whole idea was is all these people were pushing on, whether they finished it in record time, you know, 2-3 hours, or, you know, it took them 6 or 7 hours to finish it, that, you know, everybody was doing what they could to finish it.
I'm feeling inadequate, Kevin, because I was just thinking about training for a 5K so, and how much work that's going to be. So I
struggle to make it to the print, so, you know, it's beyond my my comprehension. Although I did once want to run the Boston Marathon, and then I realized that.
Then quickly had a better thought.
I realized that maybe it's not for me. Maybe I might try to walk it one day. So we get that, and then we'll close things out with Katrina Huff-Lamond. She is a candidate for state senate. This is the former. It's going to soon to be the former 2nd Plymouth and Bristol district. It's now going to be the District 34, so we'll talk with her to close out the show.
Hey, it's Geoff. That's what my friends call me, Geoff, 6 foot 190. I grew up on the South Shore, and now I live on the South Coast. Trust me, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm just like you. I have two little girls that are the same as yours. My wife and I go to work while they go to school, just like you. We watch reality TV and participate in social media, just like you. Mal keeps the books while I move things, pick things up, and put things down. Our friends are just like us. We all just want to live, work, and play freely. Thank you to the brave men and women who gave their lives. Thank you to the brave men and women who are currently giving their lives. Thank you to the brave civil servants that are serving our country every day. Thank you to the truck drivers and all of the workers that keep this country going. You are my heroes. You are amazing. You keep doing what you're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing, as long as we can, forever and ever, until death do us part. Like you, we stand with Ukraine. Like you, we stand for freedom. Our hearts and our prayers go out to all the people around the Ukraine. Godspeed. This message was brought to you by Brennan Smoke Shop.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
So we dive right into our conversation with State Representative Josh Cutler, representing the 6th Plymouth District.
Indeed.
And so first day of budget hearings, usually a quiet affair. When does the rubber hit the road for the House when it's talking about the budget?
It's always a little bit, it's always a busy time, I think, especially even pre-budget when we're, you know, as legislators thinking about what kind of amendments we want to file, working with our colleagues to, you know, talk about that and build support. And then, you know, budget week this week where we're, you know, filing amendments and trying to, you know, make our case on the different topics. So it's a busy time, but, you know, I think we're in a good place fiscally for the Commonwealth, which is, you know, knock on wood. One of the big things, we were talking about this off air, Kevin, is I've had the privileged term of serving as chairman of the Joint Committee on Labor and Workforce Development. And so in that role, we've done a lot of work on work. And it's come at an opportune time, as everyone knows, as I'm sure your listeners know, whether, you know, work as an employee or an employer, or you run a small business, that we're really at a critical point for our workforce, where, you know, there's many employers looking for workers, and a number of workers in need of training. And so it's really a critical time as we, you know, are emerging and really have emerged from the pandemic to chart a course forward. And so I feel really fortunate to be in this role right now, and it's given me opportunity to really to be an advocate on behalf of the South Shore, you know, on a statewide level for our workforce and labor issues. And you mentioned a couple of them in the promo there. But one thing we did that I had the privilege of co-chairing was our Future of Work Commission. And this is a commission that was set up by the legislature. I was appointed by the Speaker of the House and served as co-chair along with my fellow co-chair, Senator Eric Lesser. And in fact, one of our members was Representative Kathy Lenatra from the South Shore as well. So we had good representation here on the South Shore. And we traveled around the state. We had a bipartisan 17-member commission with business, labor, higher education leaders from across the state. And really, you know, had a listening tour to hear from different folks, business owners, workers, employees, apprentices, higher education experts, to kind of hear what, you know, what some of the challenges that people were seeing and what the solutions might be moving forward as we kind of try to look ahead over the next 5 to 10 years for the future of work in Massachusetts. And we, you know, as you can imagine, we spent considerable amount of time, and we came up with a number of recommendations and some analysis. And, you know, I don't think it's terribly surprising, but, you know, some important points that we saw. Number one, you know, we need to dramatically expand our workforce development capacity to reskill and upskill our workers. The current estimates show that we have, you know, up to 400,000 of our state's workers being displaced because of changes in jobs, changes in technology. And so that's going to require us to, you know, reskill or upskill our between 30,000 and 40,000 workers a year, which is really double the amount that we're doing in the past. So we really need to put more revenue, and we have, and we can talk about the budget in a moment, into those areas to help reskill and upskill our workers. The other thing, you know, we're in a labor shortage. You know, this was something that we saw before COVID. I think COVID has exacerbated it. I think it's primarily, you know, there's a number of causes of that. I think primarily it's demographic-based. You know, our population is aging, and the, you know, the generation of sort of a boomer generation, as my son would call it, is aging into retirement, and you know, they're not being replaced at the same rate from the new generation. And so we have, you know, we're seeing labor shortages. It's being exacerbated by things, you know, like with COVID, with childcare. You know, we're seeing a lot of women who are not able to re-enter the workforce, and men too, primarily women, in many cases due to childcare issues and the accessibility and affordability of childcare. So we're seeing, and we're facing some short-term and, you know, probably medium-term labor shortages. And so what's the solution there? Well, we need to, you know, make sure we're training the workers that we already have for the jobs that are open, but we also need to tap into underutilized pools of workers. That means people with disabilities. That means people who are emerging from a period of incarceration. You know, women who weren't able to enter the workforce because of childcare issues. You name it. We need to kind of be a little bit creative. Which brings me to the next point, which is we really need to close the child care gap for working families. And that was one of the things that came up again and again. You know, it doesn't make sense for you to go out to work if you're paying the same amount of money that you're making to someone to take care for child care. And so that's a recurring theme that we heard, and I know many folks out there listening, I'm sure, have experienced that firsthand. And I'll give you a quick little anecdote, because there's a lot of numbers I could throw at you, but I'll tell a quick little story. I recently went and visited a local Head Start program in the area. And, you know, it's something I do every year along with my colleagues. We read to the kids. It's a fun kind of thing, Read Across America Day. But on this particular visit, you know, that lovely visit, the teachers were great, the staff was great, but they were shorthanded because they'd already had some folks who were out. They were having trouble filling some of the positions. And then that particular day, there was one of the teachers who had to call in sick. And so they had a sort of a double whammy staffing shortage, and so they had to weren't able to offer one of the classes that would have been offered that morning. So that meant that a dozen kids were not able to come into this Head Start program today because there was no teachers there to care for them. And so think about the ripple effect of that. Okay, so you know, just those two teachers were not available. So that meant that all those families now had to scramble and make decisions about their child care, and that might mean some of them can't go to work. And so you think about the downstream effect of that and how that can have an impact, something small, just, you know, one teacher being, you know, having to call in sick. And so that really struck home to me how important it is, the childcare issue, but also just, you know, looking at our labor issues in general, because it does have, you know, we're all connected, and you know, what impacts us over here can impact us over here. So that was one of the big recommendations that we saw. And obviously, you know, we're looking at changes in the nature of work. You know, remote work, hybrid work is something that's certainly here to stay. And so how can we help to accommodate that? We're seeing shifts where some people are, you know, this is a good shift, I think, where, you know, spending more time in their own towns instead of commuting to the city. And so how can we do a better job of accommodating that, supporting our small businesses? So those are just a few of the things that we kind of took a look at, Kevin, and saw. And it kind of dovetails into nicely into talking about the budget. You just asked me about our state budget because, you know, we've really tried this year. I give credit to Chairman Michalowicz and Speaker Mariano, really put a lot of emphasis on workforce resources and putting money into our workers. And as the chair of the Labor Committee, I'm really delighted to see that. I had an opportunity last week to do a sort of a budget preview, and we went to a local child care center in the city in Boston to make some announcements. And one of which was an announcement that I think, in fact, I was talking to one of the folks downstairs about this, is to offer loan repayment, additional revenues for a loan repayment program for folks who want to get into mental health field, because we know that it's challenging to find workers there. And so offering a loan forgiveness program is one way to help people who want to, you know, pursue that field, maybe have a passion for that and really want to do that, but, you know, are fiscally, you know, maybe concerned about the ability to support their families on that kind of a salary. And so that's one way to do that. We also announced a new future teachers program, Tomorrow's Educators program, it's called. We're going to provide tuition reimbursement for students who want to go into the teaching field if they go to one of the Massachusetts public state colleges. So another way to kind of look at ways we can incentivize people to go to jobs and roles that we know are so critical to our economy. So lots of good things going on. Those are a couple of the line items that that I think, you know, are really important. But I could talk your ear off about this for a while, but I'll stop there.
A member of your former law team, Mr. Cantwell.
Yes.
Wanted me to say say hello to you, which we
I'm
know.
Supposed to meet him later today.
He does work with one of our U.S. senators here.
Yes.
In Massachusetts, so it's good to hear from Jim, and again passing along a hello to you. When it comes to our workforce, and the thing that I was hearing in the news today was the possibility of a recession. Now, is this something that we're going to see across the country, or something that, you know, will happen in, you know, the Commonwealth here? Is that something where if we have a strong workforce, that's something that's going to stave off another recession like we saw in 2008?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not an economist, but, all the economic data that we see is positive. I mean, you know, the kinds of challenges that we're having are, you know, a shortage of workers, which is, you know, is a challenge, but certainly, you know, it's a good problem to have, I guess, in a sense. You know, our economy continues to move along. I think obviously the housing market, you know, and some of the changes at the federal level with the rates rising, that, you know, I think is concern. But, you know, that may be something that needed to happen. I guess I'm more optimistic about that. I'm certainly no expert though. So, you know, hopefully, knock on wood, that will not be the case. But, you know, it makes me kind of leads into what I want to mention next, Kevin, which is that, you know, one of the things that we've done is put some extra funding into our Mass Hire program. People may be familiar with that. Mass Hire is regional workforce boards that we have all over the state. We have one that covers the South Shore area, basically Quincy down to Plymouth. And we have another one that covers the city of Brockton. And so we were able to, in the budget this year that we're just doing this week, add $5.5 million to that line item to bring it up to $15 million. So that will bring extra funds to the Mass Hire program, and that will translate, did some quick math, that will translate to our local Mass Hire board getting about $320,000 more than it did in the past. And so that's going to be a great resource to help support not only workers looking for work, looking to get connected into, you know, maybe they're changing fields, maybe they want to learn new skills to get, you know, get a higher paying job, but also businesses that are, we know, having trouble finding people. And so
it's a big problem.
It's a big problem. I was just at a local coffee shop, and I overheard the manager talking about trying to interview candidates and having trouble doing that. So we know that that is an issue. So our Mass Hire, our workforce boards are really a great resources for workers and for businesses as well. And so we're increasing funding for that, recognizing that, you know, this is such a critical time in that. And the other thing I wanted to mention I was at with Governor Baker recently announced, this was 2 weeks ago now, a new program called the Mass Hire Now program, which offers a $4,000 credit to employers to be used either to give a bonus to a new employee or to provide training for a new employee. So another way to incentivize folks,
bring
people on board. And so that's been so popular. I think it's now oversubscribed. So hopefully we'll be able to potentially to look at some other future funding for that. But that is something that was just announced just recently in the Mass Hire Now program. So we're trying to look at different, I think the bottom line is, Kevin, we're trying to look at different creative ways that we can solve these kind of problems that we're seeing with our workforce and provide the resources and supports for people to do that.
What about as far as any legislation for folks who are working but may not be paid what they should be paid? I believe that there's a wage theft bill that is in the works. Am I correct?
Yeah, so that's a whole nother issue that I've been spending a lot of time on. It's something that the issue of wage theft is something that we take very seriously in Massachusetts. And, you know, it's a concern, especially in certain sectors of the economy. I think primarily in terms of this discussion, it's something we've been talking about in the construction field because mm-hmm. a lot of concern. And so we've been in the House working. We had sort of an informal working group of leaders in the construction and building trades and also on the management side and the business side, trying to come up with some legislation to address these wage theft issues that we see. And I think everybody agrees on the problem. Obviously, getting to the solution sometimes it requires a little bit of consensus building to find the common ground. But we did recently release a good bill from the Labor Committee, which I have the privilege of chairing, that does, I think, does a good job of finding some solutions that I'm hopeful that we can find common ground on and push forward. So that was the wage theft bill was something I know a lot of folks have interest in and really hopeful that we'll be able to move forward on that.
Well, a part of this, if I'm correct, is that you mentioned construction. A lot of times is that you can get rate for certain jobs, and sometimes an employer might want to classify somebody as a low-tiered position when, in fact, they are qualified for something high.
Yeah, no, we see that misclassification of workers. That is something, again, we're not trying to penalize the people who make the innocent mistakes, the good faith mistakes, and we know that happens. But there are a certain small number of bad actors that do sort of build their business model on those kind of decisions that, hurt workers and frankly, hurt the good guys and gals that are, in business that are doing it the right way. And so that's why we've, I think, frankly, been able to find some consensus is that everybody wants to stop this. So
something to look at.
Okay. Something to look at. Yeah, there's always lots of stuff to look at, Kevin.
I want to kind of give you an opportunity to, while we have a couple of minutes left here, to talk about you have another author talk coming up where is this taking place? Is it within district or is it out of district?
Slightly out of district.
Oh, okay, where is it?
So we're doing, thanks for letting me, a little book plug here. Again, this is...
The Boston's Gentleman's
Mob. My sort of hobby when I'm not legislating is I enjoy history, I enjoy writing, and so I published a book called The Boston Gentleman's Mob, which you've been kind enough have me on in the past to talk about. And we're doing another book talk. This one's going to be in Whitman. It's on the Whitman Public Library on Saturday, May 21st at 11 a.m. in the community room. And so we'll be doing a book talk and author signing, and look forward to that. It'd be fun. I've done a few of these events, the one in Weymouth and Hanson and Duxbury, and so I've been enjoying talking about this book, which is focused on the abolition riot, the anti-abolition riot of 1835, and Mariah Chapman, who was a Weymouth resident and an abolitionist who was a courageous woman who did some pretty cool stuff. And I want to give away all the good stuff in the book, but it's a good tale, and it's true.
Now, when you do some of these author talks out of district, does the local legislative individuals from the South Shore come out? I mean, see... Representative Sullivan coming in?
I don't know, but
I've
been very fortunate. My colleagues have come and joined me. I know when I did the big launch, Senator O'Connor and Representative Murphy's sent staff. And my colleagues have been very kind in supporting this endeavor, and I'm sure they'll continue to do that.
As we have another minute or two before we wrap up, anything we haven't touched upon?
Well, I wanted to put in a plug, Kevin, for internship program, because I know we're getting to the deadline, and I know there's probably some college students out there, or maybe some parents who are looking to find some activities for their students this summer. And we're looking for interns for our state house now that we're able to be back at the state house, which is fantastic. So our internship program is going to be operating this summer, and so we're setting a deadline of it's Friday, May 13th. Friday the 13th, I should.
Interesting.
Yes. For folks who might be interested in serving as an intern this summer for us, if they're a college student, you can go to my website at joshcutler.com, and there's some more information about how to sign up. We've always had some great interns over the years. In fact, a number of my aides now were former interns. And so it's a great way to kind of get some experience, and we enjoy having the kind of youthful exuberance and new ideas and fresh ideas that our interns bring. So trying to put a little plug in for that. So a book plug, an intern plug, a budget plug.
Legislative committee report plug.
And look at that. We just hit our time.
On the mark.
Look at that.
Anything in closing, if folks want to find out more, or if you have constituents who want to reach out to you, how can they do that?
My website is probably the easiest way to find everything else out. JoshCutler.com.
Flush with information.
Yes.
Go Representative, Celtics. Thank you. So, yeah, go Celtics. Hopefully they'll sweep tonight. Continued good work, and hopefully you won't go that late into the night over the next couple of days, pushing out House Budget Number 2. He is Representative Josh Cutler, who has been our guest, and we're going to step aside when we come back. More Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Are you worried about your drinking?
Or is someone else worried about your drinking?
Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
There is no shame in living with a disease called alcoholism.
Regardless of your age, employment, or any other circumstances in your life, you deserve help from other individuals who understand what you are going through. Alcoholics Anonymous is here for you 24/7 at AA.org. Find online meetings at AAboston.org.
The pandemic is over and life is finally returning to normal. It's time to return to McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman. Come enjoy Shepherd's Pie, a pint of Guinness, and one of the best pizzas you'll ever have on the South Shore. Play Singo Wednesday nights at McGuigan's or listen to the live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night. For comfort food with an Irish pub atmosphere, go to McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out the patio at McGuigan's next door at 552 Washington Street.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Time for us to get our voices in shape. Actually, we would need your ears, because joining me right now is Donica Buckley, and she is the artistic director and conductor for the Choral Arts Society of the South Shore. We're going to find out a little bit about the society and about a great event that they got coming up in Hingham, May 1st, 4 p.m. What a Wonderful World, Songs of Earth, Sea, and Sky. Donica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
We want to first probably thank Michelle McGrath, who does a lot of the public relations for a lot of the choral groups and a lot of the great organizations that happen on the South Shore. So first, a tip of the cap to her.
Yeah, absolutely. McGrath PR. She's great.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been conducting for many years and went to Boston Conservatory for my master's in conducting at sort of a later age than most, but very glad I did so. And as a result of that, I found out about the Choral Arts Society when they were looking for a new conductor in 2005, and I didn't think I'd get the job, and I did. And so I've been with them ever since. Yeah.
Give us a little history about the Choral Arts Society of the South Shore. I mean, how long have they been around? Is it strictly volunteer? Do they seek professionals?
Well, They started in 1958 when William T. Adams, who was the music teacher at Scituate at the time, directed the school chorus. He founded the group, and so it was heavily based in Scituate, and we still rehearse there and perform there, but we also, we added Of the South Shore as part of our title a few years ago to represent more truly, because we perform in different towns and we draw membership from all of the towns on the South Shore. And so he formed the group, and it just really kept going quite strongly, and so we're really glad about that. And we, in his honor, named our scholarship when we started a scholarship fund for to give to a high school senior each year. Our first one was in 2009, and it's the William T. Adams Scholarship. So it's a nice tribute to him. And there are people who will come up to me at a concert and tell me that they had Mr. Adams for their chorus teacher. Even today, so.
So, talk to me about leading this group and what it's like, and when you are preparing for a performance, what goes into preparing for a performance like this one?
Well, I can also answer a little part of the other question that I forgot, which is to say that it is volunteers. We do occasionally hire a few extra singers. I know a lot of the young singers who do this for many choruses in the Boston area, and so if we are needing a couple of extra voices, we hire some, and we're having a few of those this weekend. We definitely are a little lower in membership than usual because of COVID, but we're holding on. And first, I plan a program and work with the board to make all the other things happen that need to go into running the chorus, which is a lot. They do a lot of volunteer behind-the-scenes work. And we rehearse every Tuesday night for a couple of hours. And I'm a big believer in vocal health, healthy singing, so I don't want anyone to go home with a sore throat because they've been rehearsing. So we do vocal warm-ups and even some stretching and getting our bodies going, and then a lot of breathing. And then we go through our music, and I you know, we obviously don't rehearse every song every week, but we get the job done. So, and it's a lot of fun. It's about community as well. It's certainly about singing and a quality performance, but people are there because they want to be together and singing, and that's a very powerful motivator.
Now, is this performance coming up on May 1st one of a few that you've already done since the pandemic, or is this one of your first since the pandemic? Because we're starting to see that light at the end of the tunnel is getting brighter and brighter, evidently.
Yes, it is. And well, back up just a smidge. In the spring of 2020, we had a really big performance scheduled. I also conduct the Cape Cod Chorale, which rehearses in Sandwich. And so I had put the two choruses together for a major performance of works by both Felix and Fanny Mendelssohn, who are brother and sister. And we were going to do it with a full orchestra, both choruses. It was going to be a concert in Scituate, a concert in Sandwich. It was really exciting. And then in February 2020, I unfortunately got hit by a snowboarder and was pretty injured and had to cancel. And I felt awful, of course. And then 2 weeks later, the pandemic shut everything down. And the choruses, both choruses, with sort of a wink and a nudge, said, well, you know, thanks for taking one for the team, because you may have saved us all from getting COVID. So that was then. And then we went to online, where we did Zoom rehearsals, which are very challenging. You know, you can't, it's not a choral rehearsal.
Yeah, somebody has a little bit of a lag.
You can't sing together. It involves everyone having their sound off, except they're listening to me and they're singing in their living rooms. And we did our best to stay together. And it was important for our sense of community and friendship. And we did produce virtual choir videos, which became quite the thing at the time. And we had a virtual choir video concert in December that year, and then one in the spring of 21. And our first concert back was this past December, and that was exciting. We were only allowed to have 110 in the space. We usually have over 200. But by golly, there were 110 people there, so that really spoke to us. You know, everyone was so thrilled. So we filled to the amount we were allowed to fill. And people were just ecstatic to see us after over 500 days. And then this is even more exciting because here we go. We will be singing the performance masked because of Omicron. We've chosen to do that out of safety for the chorus and the instrumentalists and the audience. The audience, it's optional. But we are getting there. And so, yeah, we're glad to be back.
What goes into locating a space? Because the acoustics can be everything. So you're going to be performing. This performance is going to be at the House of Prayer Lutheran Church. This is 916 Main Street in Hingham.
Yeah.
What is this space like?
Oh, it's a great space. We did a few years ago. We've done two other concerts there. One year we did the Christmas portion of the Messiah and the Bach Magnificat, and we had brass and strings and the chorus, and it was incredible. It was a great sound in there. It's pretty live space. And then we also did a Bach and Beatles concert there, which was equally interesting and good for the space. So we haven't been back there in a while, but yeah, it's a terrific space. It is one of our favorite places. We do get around to other spaces. Sometimes it's not always necessarily the best acoustic. It's how much the audience, you know, the seating, how many people can we fit, how is there a good enough place for the chorus to stand, because sometimes you have to cram in the chorus, how's the piano. So there are a lot of factors that go into it, and we perform there. We perform at St. Luke's in Scituate quite a bit. One of the middle schools has a fantastic, either Hanover or Hingham, I'm sorry, I can't remember right this moment, but also Scituate High School is a great place too. So
you mentioned pianist. You have a pianist for this particular performance?
Yes, Elisis Kwan is our collaborative pianist or accompanist, and she runs a wonderful music school in Quincy where she's a just piano teacher extraordinaire. But she's also a great soloist and a great collaborative pianist. And I've been privileged to work with her for I can't remember how many years. It's a few now, and we have a great time. And Elisis Kwan just makes life wonderful to work with.
So what are some of the pieces or some of the works that folks can come out and enjoy during What a Wonderful World?
Well, I took the inspiration from that song, of course, which is such a great old song with Louis Armstrong, you might think of. But we have an arrangement of it it's really different and interesting. The arranger based it on, I'm going to mess up his name, but the famous arrangement of the Hawaiian man who does Somewhere Over the Rainbow with ukulele. Mm-hmm. I know his first name is Israel, but I don't want to say his last name wrong. Anyway.
I think Israel will do it. And
yeah.
I'm just going to tell you right now.
Go.
He probably... No, you still have a few minutes.
Okay.
No. It's probably a really good chance he probably won't hear this and hear you not say his name.
Actually, I think he's also passed away. So that's... Okay. but I feel very terrible that I didn't practice his name. But anyway, he was a great musician and very inspirational. And he did a recording that probably many of us have heard of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's very charming with a Hawaiian flair to it. So the arranger of What a Wonderful World made it sound a little bit like that. So it's different from what we know of that song, but I think it's very interesting and a lot of fun. So we open with that. And I was just inspired to do this program because years ago we'd done one that I called Earthly Delights, which was a lot about animals and also earth. And the chorus loved doing it and the audience loved it. So I brought back a couple of the songs that we'd done before, but then I really wanted to give it an environmental focus. Music is such a powerful force in the world for good, for change, for solidarity, for community, and for collaboration. And so I really wanted to bring a lot of those things to the forefront, and we hear so much about our environment here on the South Shore. It's a pretty fragile environment. water in towns, water at the coast and the rivers, and then wildlife refuges, and just a lot going on in the environment here. And so I thought it would be great. I think we're even more powerful if we can collaborate. So I, the second part of that title of Earth, Sea, and Sky, I wanted to invite three environmental groups from the South Shore to collaborate.
I was going to segue to that, yes.
Yeah.
So you've got the North and South River Watershed Association and the Cohasset Center for Student Coastal Research and the Massachusetts Audubon Society.
Yes, and we're super excited because they're going to have a representative from each of those who will just speak for 1 or 2 minutes before the section of the program that applies to them. So the Cohasset Center will speak before a piece called Oceanus, which is lovely and lilting and beautiful, kind of a boat bobbing on the waves. And then we segue from this lovely lilting piece to maybe my favorite, Under the Sea from Little Mermaid, which is just so much fun to sing. So they'll speak before that. And then the North and South Rivers Watershed will speak before we sing a song about a lake. And then maybe one of the most important parts of the program, which is called Singing for Water, and I'll come back to that, but the Mass Audubon will speak before we sing a couple songs about birds. And then around the, I mean, there's everything. There are songs about trees, the sky, it's incredible. But Singing for Water is an important piece of the program.
Now, we had mentioned a pianist. Now, is the pianist going to be accompanied with another instrument or someone else who's going to be on another instrument?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We're thrilled to have Sally Cole Tucker, who is the former band director of Scituate High School for many years, and she's fabulous, and her instrument is flute, among others. So she's going to play flute for us on one of the bird songs, and then for Singing for Water, she'll be playing recorder, which really fits the character of the piece. And it's also accompanied by percussion, so a couple of the choral members will be playing percussion along on a couple of pieces. But Singing for Water is recorder, piano, and percussion.
And how, knowing that this is, less than a week away.
Yeah.
From, so like, what is you know, the week leading up to the big performance? Everything still, you pulling everything together? Or is
we
everybody
sure
kind
are.
Of sounding great?
Yeah, actually, it's we've had great rehearsals. And amid the COVID challenges, you know, we started the season late. We had a couple of Sunday rehearsals to make up for it. And people in the Choral Arts Society of South Shore work extremely hard at learning their parts. They have parts file practice CDs and that they listen to. People really practice. It's got a good practice ethic. And all that said, yeah, it can be challenging. So we have our sort of regular rehearsal Tuesday night, but Sally's going to come so we can hear what things sound like with the instruments, and then dress rehearsal Friday night, and then Sunday afternoon's the concert, and I think it's pulling together beautifully.
And just to let folks know again, we speak with Danica Buckley. She is the artistic director and conductor for the Choral Arts Society of the South Shore, talking about a great performance that's going to be coming up Sunday, May 1st, 4 p.m. at the House of Prayer Lutheran Church. This is 916 Main Street in Hingham. Details, how can folks who are listening to this or have been reading stuff online, how can they get tickets?
They can go online to our website, which is choralartsociety.org. And it's one art, choralartsociety.org. They can also get them at the door, or if they happen to know a choral member from one of the many towns, they can do it that way. So,
tickets will be at the door.
Yep.
Right? And again, this is an environmental collaboration, nature themed. And think about it. Here we are. We're in the spring. What
yes.
a fantastic time of year to get out and to hear some great performances by the Choral Art Society. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Anything you want to say in closing?
Oh, gosh. Well, just that there's a lot of variety to the program. There are lively pieces, there's humor and fun, and also a lot of meaningful things. So I think it's a great way, and it's only an hour long, start to finish. It's a great way to spend an hour on a spring afternoon in May.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing these details, and hopefully if someone has the afternoon free on Sunday, they'll pop on in and be able to enjoy some great music.
I hope they will, too. It will give them great inspiration to go back to their gardening afterward.
We are going to step aside, and when we come back, hour number two of Monday Night Talk, right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to AA.org. To find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit aaboston.org.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than two or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
With summer coming, it's time to enjoy alfresco dining at the Patio at McGuigan's. The Patio at McGuigan's serves up dishes like Koji steak tips, 14-ounce pork chops, and chicken masala. Have you heard about the Patio Sampler Platter? It's a dish worth driving to. And you can enjoy live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night at the Patio at McGuigan's. Patio at McGuigan's is at 552 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out McGuigan's Pub next door at 546 Washington Street.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Right, welcome back. Hour number two, more show. Late in this hour, Katrina Huff Lamond for State Senate. She, of course, is running for what used to be the 2nd Plymouth and Bristol,
which is currently occupied by State Senator Mike Brady, is going to become District 34 due to redistricting. So we'll talk with her at the bottom of the hour. But right now, we have a gentleman who is, he's been a reoccurring guest, and we've had him in here for many a good reason, many good discussions. And I think probably one of the earliest ones that I reminisced earlier in the show was when you had your son Dominic in here for Dom's Dime.
Absolutely.
So he's feeling a little philanthropic and wanted to help others.
Yep. Still at it.
Still at it. You know, stack up the dimes. Let's go. And we've talked about other things, the legal beagle stuff.
Yep.
But your story, you've evolved, and you, last year we had you on. I want to say it might have been August, September-ish, when you ran the 125th.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
But it wasn't you didn't run it necessarily. You ran the race. You ran the miles.
Ran the course, the actual Boston course.
But it was different at that time, right?
Boston, because of the pandemic,
yes.
they only allowed 10,000 runners on the actual Marathon Monday, which they moved to October for the first time in 125 years. So they allowed for virtual runners. So there were people running all over the world. As long as they were clocking 26.2, they could do it on a treadmill. They could do. You know, we had folks, and the community is tremendous, you know, of people who run marathons and distances. People were running in the middle of the night in Afghanistan, because it's the only time that they could get weather that was sub 80 degrees where they could actually run and run safely. So they're running in yellow vests in the middle of the night to get the miles in. I live here in the area, so I figured it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do it anywhere else other than on the course. So I did that on the Saturday before. So
you did it last October.
Yep.
What? So this past Monday, a week ago from today.
Yes.
You probably just about ran around now across the finish line?
I finished a little bit after 6 p.m., so okay. Yeah.
Right, so right around the time.
Yep.
Right? What was last Monday like for you?
Doing it, quote-unquote, for real, you know, was a tremendous experience. Because it's an all-day event, literally. Mm-hmm. You're up early. You're meeting the TED. I run with the Mass General Hospital team. That's an offshoot of John Hancock, and they had we all met in Boston Common at 8 o'clock, because the streets in Hopkinton close at 7 a.m. You're not driving yourself to get there.
It's not happening.
So there are buses that leave from Boston Common every 15 minutes that are taking the 30,000 plus runners up to Hopkinton for the 30-40 minute ride, and two things happen. You're loaded in and you're seeing all of these different runners from all over the country and all over the state and all over the world, and you're realizing just what type of an experience you're about to have. You also get a real sense as to just how long 26 miles is, because you're in a bus driving from Boston to Hopkinton and the time is going by and you're realizing, oh, we're far away. And it hits you. If it hasn't hit you before, that's when it does hit you. And then you're in the village. Even though we're leaving in the fourth wave of runners, early on, the pros go, professional men.
Wait. Did they put you with the Kenyans?
No. Although there might have been a few in my pile. You know, I'm just, yeah. It's a lesson that, you know, Congressman Steve Lynch, you know, gave me in September when I ran it the first time. I bumped into him at an event in Whitman, and he's run the marathon he's run Boston two or three times.
Blue-collar
guy. The Marine marathon once, and he said, "Chris, I got two bits of advice for you. One, don't try to chase any Kenyans, Ethiopians, none of them. You're not chasing them. You're not going to catch them. The second bit of advice is you're going to be cruising along like 12, 13 miles in. You're going to be going, and all of a sudden, you're feeling great about yourself. This 80-year-old guy is just going to go whipping right past you. Don't chase him because you think he's 80 and you're 55 and you got to go chase him down. You are not catching him." So the same, you know, those things stuck with me, and it did in fact happen where I am not beating any Kenyans, and right around mile 10, right as I'm heading into Natick, not just an old guy, a guy dressed as Ben Franklin, an old, had to be in his 70s, in a full-on colonial outfit, just went busting past me, and I shook my head, and I started, as people were like cheering Ben Franklin on, and I'm cruising along, and I looked at the crowd, and I just got my butt whipped by Ben Franklin. I'm getting passed by a founding father. What's happening? And so you got to chase him down.
You really want to chase time, though? Come on.
You know, I chased him down a little bit, caught up to him, had a little conversation with him, and then he just left me behind, and that was it, because you got to run your own race. You don't run anybody else.
Let's kind of go back prior to your first run.
Yep.
And just as a reminder to folks, what initially motivated you to run the marathon? And also tell folks as to you actually went through a little bit of a transformation. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One of the earlier times where you met me was, I'm a big guy now. I was a much bigger guy then. Pushing 400 pounds, I had gotten up as, when I ran for Selectman in Whitman 3+ years ago now, I was just about 415 pounds. Walking around town, knocking on doors at 415, not a healthy situation. So I got to a point where it was extremely unhealthy. And at that age, with young kids, I had to make a change. So I had a gastric sleeve surgery. And dropped over 120 pounds. I'm now hovering at a weight where I'm comfortable. It's not, you know, I'm by no means svelte, but this is the body I'm in. I'm running at 275, give or take a pound on any given day, depending on what dinner was. But that, it was a big physical change. But along with that, I promised myself that if I can get to a point in my physical being and well-being that I can go run again, I want to try. And I didn't have marathons on the mind necessarily, but I, you know, one of those bucket list things you think about where I want to run a marathon by the time I'm 60. I'm 55 years old now. At the time I had the surgery, I was 52. Just heading into 53. So I had the surgery, dropped the weight when I got under 300 pounds. I talked to my doctor and said, can I go run? I said, can you? You should be. Go do it. So I just started putting on the shoes and going, and got a 5K under my belt, first time. Okay, well, I can do this now. Now I can do a 10K. So I ran for Dana-Farber and did the, you know, a 10K and raised some money for Dana-Farber on the Boston course. So I, you know, started, you know, right on Heartbreak Hill, did that, and then finished with my friend Dave Troilo, who ran with me at that point. And once you do that and you feel it and you cross that line, all of a sudden it hits you in your head. Like, you know, what if I tried? What if I tried? So I put it in my head. This is something that you can do, even though it's not something that people will look at you and say, you are not a marathon runner. You don't look it. You don't seem it. You know, and I love doing things that people don't expect.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment, because I want to touch upon a few things. But what was the training like? What was it like to get acclimated and almost like, you know, maybe you run the first couple of weeks, you're running X amount of miles, and then I'm able to do X amount of miles. Right. I'm going to try to expand it.
I had gotten to a point where I could do the 10K, and I used one of those an app on your phone that, you know, helps you get to that point. So I got to where I could do a half marathon, did 13.1 miles, and you know, at that point it's a reality. I can do this. It felt like hell, but now I can do two of these back to back. You'll be fine. One of the benefits of running with a team is Mass General has a long-standing relationship with the owner of Heartbreak Hill Running Company, Dan Fitzgerald, who is a marathon runner himself, run Boston multiple times. And he is the official coach for Mass General. So he puts together a program, whether you are a beginning marathoner or an intermediate marathoner or a pro, he puts a program together, 20 weeks. And you start out week one, you do one long distance run every week, and you're adding distance every week. But during the week, it's building up strength. It's, you know, running, you know, 3 to 5 miles during the week, but you're running at a faster speed. You're trying to build up strength. And then you pick another day. Your Tuesdays and Thursdays are like more geared towards skills. Like you're going to run hills. So you're going to run, you know, five times, you know, you're going to run this particular hill five times at one pace. And then you're going to run it for a shorter period of time, but at a faster pace. And you're building up the strength that's going to get you to a point where when you're faced with those four hills in Newton, that you're not going to be knocked down. You're building up the strength. And then you're building up endurance as you go, and you're building what they refer to as signature speed to get yourself to a point where you're in those rolling flats and you can build up time, then you do it. But then on Saturday, every Saturday, it's the long distance. So all of the work that you did during the week, you're adding up. So first week, you're doing 6 on a Saturday. Then you're doing 8 the following Saturday. The next Saturday, you're doing 10. Then you drop back, never adding more than, you know, never going more than 3 weeks with adding. You always step back a little bit and give yourself a break. But over the course of time, you're building up to a point where, and when I ran it in October, you know, the longest run of the program is 20 miles. And you do that 20 and you feel beat. You're just, you're dead from the head down. Everything hurts. And every marathoner will tell you, if you can run 20, you can run 26. Mentally, I could not wrap my head around that, because I know how a 10K for anybody, you know, for me, a 10K is about 70 to 75 minutes. I could not mentally see myself adding another 75 minutes to the 4+ hours that I had just spent running, you know, distance. So while you can train yourself physically to be able to physically do the event, the better part of marathon running and distance running happens from the neck up, not the neck down.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Chris Diorio, who last Monday, was one of those thousands of runners who competed in the 126th annual Boston Marathon. What challenges did you face during your training, and did it translate to being anything that you were able to overcome during the race itself?
Training this time in for the race on the actual day, had to deal a lot more with differing weather. But one of the mantras that you learn along the way is that you run in everything so that you can, you know, you train in everything so that you can run in anything. So while it's, you know, snow and sleet on the ground in February, you're strapping on the shoes and you're getting out there. If it's below free, if it's single digits, I'm hitting the treadmill. So you've got to adjust, same as you would on the course, because you don't know on a given day what you're going to be facing. It could be wet. It could, in 2018, you know, it's the horror story that people will tell about 2018 and how it was just torrential from moment one, and the pros were falling off, you know, falling to the wayside because they couldn't take the rain. And Des Linden, you know, the female winner at that point, was the only one of the top 20 that stayed on the course, and that's why she wins, because she gets through and survives the rain, but trained in it. So physically running, training in the winter weather was different than training over the summer, because you don't have to really worry about that, but you're training in heat. So when you get to October to run, different story, you have much better weather. We were really and truly blessed that we had all runners would refer to as a great running day. You know, started out in the mid 40s, topped off in the mid 50s. A little bit of a headwind at some point, that was a little challenging. But you know, just individual to me, cramps. When I ran in October, I made mistakes. Ran into cramps right between mile 16 and mile 17.
Cramps because of dehydration?
That's the thing. So the first mistake was I missed a hydration stop. And you also have to take nutrition in it as you go. It's not just water. You're losing glycogen and all sorts of things. So you're taking, you know, like hydrogels and things of that nature that will replenish the glucose in your body and you know, set you up so that you can continue to go. And I never really thought about eating a banana while you're running. It just seemed anathema to me that you'd be eating while you're going through this process. But they're out there. They're eating, you know, waffles and people like with bags of almonds, and they're eating while they run. I'm like, you're insane. This is crazy. Now I know why. So the second time out, took, you know, running on Monday, every water stop, take water, whether you need it or not. Take the water. Take, you know, and had this what they refer to as salt shoes that are electrolyte replenishers, but also sodium and calcium replenishers. And you take those every 30 minutes. Did that. Had the hydrogels. Did everything I was supposed to do. And right before the first hill, cramps in the calves. And before you get to that first hill, cramping up as you're heading over 95 is not fun. So you pull up a little bit. But I didn't make the mistake that I made last year. Last year I stopped. And when you stop with a cramp, the cramp has a tendency to migrate. And it went up into my thighs and into my hips, and I was frozen for 20 minutes, couldn't move until the cramp decided it was going to go away. This time, moved through it. It sort of popped its way out, kept coming back, but I just kept moving, and it slowed me down a lot. Got through the hills slowly, but got through them. And then once you get to BC, it's, you know, maybe a couple miles of dead zone, and then you're on your way, because there's no way you're going to stop when you get there.
No one ever takes a journey without learning a few things and having to endure what others have to say. You're somebody who has documented your training, the progress on social media. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that the info you shared was received? And did you get any interesting feedback?
I live my life.
Open book.
I live my life out loud to a lot of people's distress or dismay or distaste, I guess. And again, like I said earlier, I don't cut the shape of a marathon runner. So I'm documenting my training. I'm, you know, posting my times, and they're not. I'm not running 6 minute miles. I'm never going to do that. I'm posting 12 minute miles, 12 and a half minute miles, and people were. You know, I would get a message. You know, sometimes, like right there on the post, which is rare that sometimes these people actually expose themselves. Mm-hmm. Normally, they're just going to come to me privately, online, and send me a message saying, "Why are you posting these times?" I would be embarrassed if I post that time. You know, and you know, people who don't believe you're actually doing it. So you've got to show yourself actually out there on the course running. And folks would respond and say, forget about these people. None of you. At all points, regardless of the negatives that I got, you know, from these, you know, keyboard warriors that, you know, decide that they want to interject themselves into my life, at all points recognizing two things. One, that the journey is not about me.
It's much more.
The journey for me was about the message first, that you can do it, but more importantly, that the reason why I run. For the second year running for Mass General Hospital's Pediatric Cancer Clinic and their Hematology Oncology Department, the person who started the Mass General Hospital marathon team, Dr. Howard Weinstein, ran his 30th marathon on Monday and his 25th marathon as part of the Mass General team. He created the team 25 years ago. With 10 bibs that he was able to solicit from John Hancock. He went to them directly and said, we want to run and have charity runners. And so he went and got doctors and nurses and staff from the hospital, 10 runners, and said to one of his associates, I want you to pick 10 kids. And each of these runners is going to be running for one of these kids. They're what they refer to as patient partners. And these kids are out there. They brought them out on the course. And at mile 20, they're there on the course if they're physically able to be so. You know, and these runners ran for those kids. Since that point, 25 years ago, Mass General Hospital and their marathon team has raised almost $25 million. For their, you know, the three charities now, the first and largest is pediatric oncology, but they've also just recently added two other teams. One referred to as Project Home Base, which deals with the hidden wounds of war and folks coming back from the service and dealing with PTSD and other, you know, issues that Mass General has a separate program that deals with them. And the third is the Emergency Services Unit, which they brought on after the Marathon bombing in 2013. And recognizing the fast response, you know, the stories of people who finished the marathon in 2013 after the bombing took place and kept running to go to Mass General to donate blood is a tremendous story that was fostered by ESU. So these three programs now, primarily pediatric oncology, almost $25 million in donations. This year alone, the Mass General Pediatric Oncology team has raised about $1.2 million. And I'm lucky to have been a part of that team, and I'm happy that they allowed me to be part.
Yeah, and you kind of usurped my next question, which was like, why did you, there's so many great causes. And I think you kind of eloquently kind of said why all the good that they've done and what they offer and who they offer it for. So I think you kind of already answered.
And I've had folks come to, you know, in fact, just today, a runner from Texas, who I connected with when we were running virtually back in October, reached out and said, I want to run Boston. I want to run it for real. How do I do that? You know, how do I get a charity bib? Mm-hmm. She's never going to qualify. She's, you know, right around 10 or 11 minute mile, a great time for, as far as I'm concerned, but not a qualifying time. And so I said, look, the BAA, Boston Athletic Association, has a number of parent charity partners that they deal with. 47 separate charities that they, you know, officially sponsor, but John Hancock is a primary sponsor, and they have, you know, a few hundred bibs of their own that they give out. Teddy Bruschi has a marathon team. Doug Flutie has the Flutie Foundation has a marathon team. Sure. Boston Children's, Tufts Medical, any number of different charities out there. The blind runners, you know, there are folks out there with that are running with blades that, you know, Adrienne Haslett, her story is tremendous. She was a professional ballroom dancer who was at the marathon in 2013, lost her lower part of her left leg.
Yep.
Her career ended as a ballroom dancer. Got a blade put on and decided at that point, I'm going to run Boston. And this year she did it with Shalane Flanagan, you know, U.S. Olympic marathoner who engaged in one of the greatest feats I've ever seen in October, where because of the unique placement finally of putting Boston in October, ran six marathons in 42 days and ran Chicago and Boston back to back.
Goodness.
She ran Chicago on Sunday in 2 hours and 38 minutes, got on a plane, flew from O'Hare to Boston, landed in Boston at night, woke up the next morning, and ran the Boston Marathon in 2:42, and then ran New York 3 weeks later to finish the six. Just phenomenal. Shalane was Adrian's partner. It's just tremendous. And again, running for great causes. That's why.
We just got a couple of minutes left, but it's been great having you here. And when I had asked you, when we were going back and forth last week, I'm like, yep. Thinking about putting you in at 20, do you think we can? You're like, oh, we can fill a half hour, no problem at all. Probably one of my final questions is Boston media actually captured you crossing the finish line with another runner, even sharing a couple of words from you. Talk to us about that. What that person you met and crossing a line with another individual.
Crystal Chang is my new friend. You sort of find runners along the way that you're stalking and that are stalking you. You're running at the same pace, and you might pass them, and you sort of use them along the way. It's like a stalking horse. And if I stay with them, I'll be fine. And if you keep them in sight, you'll be okay. Not to best them or beat them, but just keep them in sight. You'll be fine. I got around. We passed each other a couple of times when I cramped up, and then she apparently had her own problems. Right around mile 22, making the turn from Cleveland Circle, heading down into Brookline. I'd passed her by, and she. I felt her on my shoulder, just maybe 10 feet off to my left. And I look back, and she's struggling. And I said, "You good?" And she said, "Yeah, I think if I follow you, I'll be okay. I'll make it." And that's whatever gas was missing in my tank was replenished at that point, because now for me, it's all right. It's not for me. It's not for these kids. I want to get her home. It's her first. We started talking. It was her first marathon and her last, as she said many, many times as we ran. So I said, "Come on, I got you." And so we paced the rest of the way, and she stayed with me. And I said, "All right, well, we're gonna run 8 minutes. Then we're gonna walk for one. I'm not gonna beat you up. We're just gonna get there. But we're gonna get there." And as we're going, she's a director of education with the Harvard Medical School and all this. So we stayed with each other the whole way. Made the turn, the classic turn, right on Hereford, left on Boylston, right there with her. And we, about 300 yards, 200 yards in, you can hear the crowds, and they're still there. It's 6 o'clock at night. They've already started pulling up the gates, and they're, pulling up the strips for the times. But there are still hundreds of people lining the streets. And that was the feeling that I didn't get in October that I got this time, that they're cheering. They don't care who the hell you are. You're just going. Yep. And here you are. And there's the two of us running with each other. And I looked back, she was a couple of steps behind me, and I stopped, sort of slowed down, and grabbed her hand and said, "We're going in the rest of the way. Are you good?" And she said, "If you think so, I'll do it." And we, hand in hand, ran across the finish line, crossed it. There's no way that we were going to do it anyway other than together at that point. And so we did. It was a great experience and great feeling, and Crystal's my new friend.
Last question.
Yeah.
Any plans to run another marathon or another adventure like that?
If Mass General will have me back, I'm part of the Mass General team. I'm looking ahead to 2023, I really want to run New York. But if I run New York, that's November, and that would be three marathons in 18 months, and then four. Boston would be four in 24. That's kind of nuts. As many, many runners have said, that I didn't realize until one of my friends, said to me, "Do you don't even realize that you've run two marathons inside of 6 months?"
Wow, that's crazy.
That marathoners don't do that, and you did. So I'd love to run New York, maybe sometime down the road. But right now I got my sights set on 2023 in Boston again. I want to, I ran faster this time than last time. Just keep, getting there faster. And that's the goal. Well, 1 minute faster.
Congratulations on raising over $11,000 for the Mass General Hospital team.
Kevin, thank you very much.
And thank you for sharing your story.
Of course.
Chris DiIorio has been my guest. And pay attention. You might be running New York soon. Just step aside. We'll come back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Hi, my name is Alex Bazantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the Executive Board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbazantin.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Bazantin for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
Of Tiny Sun's Glass.
If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield.
Ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing the gimme gimme that ding.
So gimme that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We have arrived at the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Joining us for this segment, we have Katrina Huff Larman. She is not only a Randolph town counselor, she's been a counselor, I think, for 6 years, going on 6 years, and she is also a candidate for state senate. Now, the Senate district that she's running for is going to soon to be the former 2nd Plymouth and Bristol district, which is now going to be called the new District 34. Katrina, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
You got it. So, for folks who may or may not know who you are, give us just a little bit of a background on yourself, please.
Absolutely. You already touched on the fact that currently I am a Randolph counselor, and I've been in office since 2015. Actually, the first woman of color that has ever sat in that seat. And then 2019, I was the first woman to be vice president of the council. So I've been doing that. I also wear a hat. I'm a clinical social worker. So I've been working with individuals for many, many years on working around issues that I see that are part of our societal issues, which is actually what motivated me, along with being a counselor, what motivated me to run for state senate, understanding the issues, seeing the issues, and indirectly or directly having to become really involved in some of the societal issues.
If you will, talk to me about some of the things that you've been able to do serving as a Randolph town counselor.
Absolutely. That has been the best learning curve, if I may say, of my whole career. And making decisions, I call it being at the table, having the opportunity to be at the table and make some of these decisions. Even if the orders that I put forward or the orders that I believe in, even if they do not, even if they're not voted on, just for them to be heard, I think is really important. So some of the work that I have done have definitely been vote by mail. In 2020, definitely we had vote by mail, and it was such a wonderful turnout. Before we received the word from federally that vote by mail would happen again, we put together an order that I was also an author on to make sure, regardless of what is said, that the town will still do practice, exercise vote by mail, and understanding that this is really important. This is the largest turnout that we have had. So that is something that I have done. I have worked with the town manager in making sure that, Randolph is a majority minority town. So we, the largest language that is spoke, or one of them, is Haitian Creole, the other Vietnamese. And then we have a population of Spanish speaking residents. So with all important vital information coming out of town hall, really understanding, especially during COVID. During COVID, it was very important for information coming out of town hall to be in multiple languages. So that was a huge push that I was really involved in, to make sure that all of our residents had the right to understand the information that was important to keep them alive. The last one I will mention is, speaking of a majority minority town, there are, I could go on and on, but this last one that I could mention is, speaking of COVID, again, my Randolph being a majority minority town, what we found with COVID is that communities of color were high risk. And knowing communities of color were high risk, and Randolph was number three in the state with numbers being extremely high, we still did not have a test center, which we thought was pretty dangerous in our town. So part of my work was to make sure that we fought for a test center. And some of that was, you know, connecting with as many people we can on the state level, on the federal level, to have our voices heard that we need a test center. But the other part of that was, you know, making sure that we could put some sort of programming together to inform our residents of what does COVID mean? Why is COVID dangerous? What are the protections that you need in order for this town that is high risk, number three in the state, to be protective? And I was really a huge part of making sure that Randolph had the right resources and was advocating for the right resources so we could protect ourselves. And, you know, and with our voices being heard and really fighting for what was right for us, we finally did get a testing center. And now we have testing center, and we have COVID vaccines, and we have lots of literature and lots of, we have equity COVID meetings. Congresswoman Presley herself came to town and said, Randolph is a role model for other towns. So now we have what we need, and we're not stopping. We're still pushing for equity around COVID. But that's definitely, one of the, opportunities I had to really push for what was needed in Randolph to protect our residents.
In your wildest dream, when you ran for town council in 2015, did you ever imagine that you would be, you know, governing during a pandemic? Did it ever come to
Absolutely
mind?
Absolutely not. It was not a thought about anything about a pandemic, you know. It wasn't, but you know, we had to shift and make it work and make sure that we could govern our town and the residents, constituents, during a pandemic, just as if we can when we were in a pandemic. There's lots of talk around workers who had to continue to be present. And recently I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues, who, you know, town council, and we talked about how we had to be present, how you can't shut down the town. You know, we still have to make decisions on, you know, whether it's roads or the budget, you know, whatever's going on, we still had to be extremely present, just had to be comfortable with pivoting and doing it a different way. But no, to answer your question, I had no idea this would be part of how I would be governing anything in my life.
If folks are just tuning in, we are speaking with Katrina Huff
Lamont, and she is a candidate for state senator. I will ask you, Katrina, what went into deciding to run for state senate, and why do you feel that it's time that this district, this new district, should have a progressive state senator?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. To answer the first question, you know, I kind of, you know, being at the table as a town councilor and recognizing the need at the local level, which is extremely important level. They, like they said, all politics is local, right? Mm-hmm. I also realized with the vote by mail was something that went through my head. Now, I want to say that although I helped author that ordinance, it didn't pass. And that was saddened to me. I was really sad about that, because it made me think that if it did not come from higher level, there will definitely have been some, in my opinion, voter suppression happening. So it made me worry about and think about, you know, what else could be done. So that was part of my decision. Like, you know, I understand that it's important for me to be at the table locally. I think it's also important for me to be at the table, or individuals who think like me, to be at the table on the state level as well. So that was part of my decision. Definitely saying, you need to also be visible at another level. People's voices need to be heard, because part of my campaign is, I don't want to go to the Senate alone. I want to bring you to the Senate. I want to bring your voices to the Senate. And I truly believe that as a social worker, right? Like, that's part of what we believe in, working with people collaboratively so all voices could be heard. So it's not far off from who I am and what I do, collaborating with constituents to bring all voices to the table. And so that has been like my push when I go out and have these conversations. I want to bring all voices to the table. It's important for every voice to be heard. And that was something that I definitely learned when that ordinance was voted down, that although I want all voices to be heard, not everyone want all voices to be heard. And that saddens me. And so what do you do about that? And as for the district, I worked really hard in this whole redistricting process. I've been part of the Unity Table, ACLU. I've had 9 p.m. phone calls with individuals and trying to figure out what makes sense. How could we develop some of these districts that that are around equity and equality? Because currently, that's not the case. And especially on the South Shore, that was not the case. So worked really hard to try to develop a district that was a majority minority district that was inclusive of the South Shore. So this District 34, as you mentioned, is Randolph, Brockton, East Bridgewater, Whitman, Hanson, Halifax, and Halifax. So at least there's an opportunity to have some progressive individual in this district. And that's important. That's important for us, to anyone who wants to, or have an interest in running for office, to at least have an opportunity. And that's what it's all about for me, an opportunity. You know, it's interesting, even getting signatures. I appreciate many individuals when their response to my plea for them to sign my nomination papers are, I think everyone should have an opportunity to at least be on the ballot. And I could really appreciate, and I've received that from both sides. So I could really appreciate that.
If you will, talk to me about your time serving as a Randolph town councilor. How do you feel that that helps you to be able to better understand the district? And the because I think that the needs are going to differ depending whether you're going to Brockton. You're talking about a city of over 100,000 people to smaller communities like Whitman and Hanson, where you have between 14 and 16,000 people. Again, having an idea of you know, serving as a town councilor, talk to me how that helps you.
So Randolph, when we were doing redistricting, we purposely were working with Randolph and Brockton and wondering about other towns and cities, you know, Stoughton, Canton, Milton. We were working with those, but we definitely were working with Randolph and Brockton coming together because we know demographically Randolph and Brockton have some of very similar needs. When we're talking about COVID, they went through some of the same issues of being number two or number four. Because I know we were number three and they were either ahead of us or right behind us of high risk of COVID cases. And we understand the languages, a number of different languages in Brockton, just as there's a number of different languages here in Randolph, the immigration population. So we have so much in common. So I feel really comfortable with connecting with Brockton and understanding that we could, you know, we have that in common. I would say with the other towns, the other reason why I feel really comfortable with that, as I mentioned, I'm a clinical social worker. Maybe I just said social worker, but I'm a clinical social worker. So I do a lot of mental health work. And I have been in every single town that is in the district and working with individual mental health cases. So that is universal. And that's also another priority of mine is understanding mental health care, understanding substance use, and how could we find policies so we could better serve these communities when they're dealing with these different issues. So being a town counselor has been helpful because it has given me the opportunity to be at the table on a local level and understand some of the culture, understand some of what it feels like to be in politics and work with the people. But I'll tell you, Kevin, what has really been more of a motivator to me is my profession of understanding that the issues that are in our society that need to be focused on, I need two vehicles. I need the vehicle of wearing my social work hat, and I need the vehicle of the experience of being a town counselor. And both of those coming together has really given me great insight on my focus on what I should focus on as a state senator.
I would ask you, and you gave me a nice segue there, you know, what do you feel are the key issues, not only in this race that the campaign's going to focus on, but issues that are going to resonate with the voters, the residents across District 34?
Oh, definitely. People feel like we're out of COVID, but we're still in COVID, right? You and I are meeting virtually. Although now we've figured this whole virtual thing is, you know, we can probably do this after COVID because it's convenient.
Yes.
but how could that work for us? ARPA monies that are coming, how does each town receive funding and how to use those fundings to recover from COVID? Small businesses, every single town is trying to figure out because of COVID. You know, we can keep going back to COVID, actually, because of COVID, many of these businesses went out of business. And so how do we recover from that? How do we help some of these small businesses get back on their feet? I'm currently thinking of an opportunity in Randolph on how we can use ARPA funds to help small businesses get back on their feet. So I'm in the process of putting it together a meeting now so we could see, can we use some of this money? Because we're still, you know, all of the towns are still trying to figure out what could they use the money for and what they can't use the money for. So we have a consultant that we're going to speak to and see how could we use the money to help small businesses. And that's not just a Randolph issue. That's not just a Brockton issue or a Whitman or a Hanson issue. That's universal. Many of these small businesses just did not do well because of COVID. That started in 2020. And I mentioned mental health, right? That's universal as well. Yep. And something that we really have to start thinking on a higher level. It's not an individual issue. I think when we think about mental health and we think about substance use, we still think about it as an individual issue, but it's a public issue. And, you know, we need to start thinking broader about how to help these individuals who are unfortunately in these situations and how we can heal them. And once we can think of it as a public health issue and be serious about thinking about it as a public health issue, then I believe more focus could be on how we could put policies in place to heal and have more resources for individuals who are having a difficult time. Again, going back to COVID, individuals with mental health issues has risen. These small businesses who have gone out of, lost their business because of COVID, that has become a major issue. And then, you know, also, you know, I'm an individual who has done a lot of work around oppression. So women's rights, rights around LGBT community, rights around race, and abilities, different abilities. So I bring all of that knowledge that I have indirectly or directly worked with to the table and understand how people are suffering and the needs that they need and the resources that need to be available.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Katrina Huff-Lamont. She is a candidate for state Senate. And we're chatting with her about her campaign. We got a few minutes left with you, Katrina. And it was funny because I was going to mention the America Rescue Plan Act funding, the ARPA funding.
Yes.
And your thoughts on, do you feel as though that our state elected officials have done enough when it comes to fairly distributing the Commonwealth's allotment of ARPA money? And what would you like to do if you're elected when it comes to oversight for your district?
Well, I'll say I would like to work on making sure that the monies are equally divided amongst the towns. I was to tell you one thing that has happened with Randolph. There's this formula that usually happens when money comes from the federal government that goes on how many residents, how many individuals are in your town, but not what is needed. It doesn't, you know, this formula doesn't assess your need. It assess how many individuals are in a town or city. And that doesn't work for Randolph because, yes, Randolph has 37,000, you know, new census coming through individuals, but our needs are high compared to maybe some other towns. So I would definitely like to look at and make sure that the needs in each town that's in my district, they're getting the appropriate funding so they can do what is needed to continue to build the town and cities up and not be taken advantage of because of their numbers of residents are low. What are their what are the risk factors? I want to look at the risk factors and make sure that they're receiving the monies that they're supposed to receive and receiving the resources that they're supposed to be receiving. Not saying, well, there's only like 17,000 people in this district, so therefore their needs are low. And that's not necessarily true at all. You can have a number of individuals in a place and the needs could be less than another population who have less individuals and the needs are higher.
Okay. We just got a couple of minutes left, but I got to make sure I ask in regards to local aid. I think local aid is a key, especially when it comes to making sure there's enough money for funding. We're talking Chapter 70 money. When it comes to a community being able to get Chapter 90 money, that means roads, sidewalks. Nobody likes potholes on their streets. And everybody likes to have that money to be able to kind of, you know, spruce up their communities. Talk to me about being a fighter for local aid.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, we're also waiting for infrastructure money to come down. So that's really important. And so, again, we need for that formula to be accurate. And the local fundings, absolutely, because you're right. No one, I receive more phone calls about the potholes on the streets and when will my street be paved
than we'll anything. Care about that.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, there's lots of energies around making sure that we have just as much of the local funding than, you know, the larger funding, because we need to keep our, you know, we need to keep the funding coming in on a regular basis. These ARPA monies, this is just like a once in a lifetime type of situation. So, yeah, we'll take it and we'll do what we're supposed to do with it. But we want to have ongoing, you know, revenue that's coming through so we can take care of towns and cities alike. To make sure the potholes and the sidewalks, and we're beautifying along with some of the other social service programming that we're trying to do as well.
We just got a minute or two left. I want to give you an opportunity. Maybe there's something that we didn't get to ask you, but you feel is kind of key that you want to mention. And also, while you're at it, if folks want to find out more about you, they want to get involved with your campaign, how can they do that?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I will definitely answer that question. Again, my name is Katrina Huff-Larman. I'm running for District 34 State Senate. I'm really excited about this opportunity. This is a new district that came out of redistricting that I was also very much involved in. And this district gives people opportunity to feel as if they can run and, you know, in some new energies. So absolutely, I can use all the assistance that anyone could provide. I have a website, KatrinaForSenate.com. Definitely visit. I have social media as well that's up. You know, not next week, but the week after, because next week is Easter. The week after, we'll be doing some door knocking in Brockton. If you want to join us, definitely go to the website and you'll be directed to where you can help us. You know, you can go to contacts, leave your name, your number, your address, whatever you feel comfortable leaving, and we would connect with you. If you want to sign, if you live in Brockton, Randolph, Halifax, Hanson, East Bridgewater, Whitman, definitely connect with me. If you will, don't mind having a sign in your yard, that would be extremely helpful. And as we continue going, there'll be phone calls and things that people can do from their home and you don't have to go out, but as much support as I can get, I appreciate. There's so much on May 24th. We'll have a kickoff campaign in Brockton at LaWanda's. So we're excited about that.
Okay.
So again, whatever you could provide, we will take and we'll take good care of you while we're at it.
We've been speaking with Katrina Huff-Larman, we want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. This has been fun. We have to do this again.
We will do it again. And we want to thank you for tuning in. You've been tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., God willing, we'll see you then.